Welcome back to Happy Porch Radio, the digital agency podcast for progressive agency owners and web professionals. Season 4 is an exploration of diversity in our industry, especially gender diversity. This season, your host, Barry O'Kane, is joined by some wonderful co-hosts for conversations with agency leaders and diversity and inclusion experts.
Hello, and welcome back to Happy Porch Radio. In this episode, we speak to Dan Robertson, who is an expert on workplace diversity, inclusion, unconscious bias, and inclusive leadership. As well as helping us to set the context for the rest of the season, Dan shares some really useful insights and specific ideas that you may find immediately thought-provoking or impactful. So let's meet Dan.
Hello, everybody. Dan Robertson, the director of Vaseda Consulting. Vaseda Consulting, we are based in the UK, but we operate globally. And we essentially advise global corporations on what we call inclusive management.
Brilliant. Thanks, Dan, and welcome to the show. I have Kelly with us as well. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, everyone. Hello.
So, Dan, we're having this conversation at the start of this season of Happy Porch. And our topic, our broad topic for this season is diversity and diversity in the agencies and diversities in teams. So, and I'm really looking forward to this conversation. And where I'd like to start, if it's okay, is kind of talking about what we mean, what diversity is, what kind of things we're talking about there, and why, in the business sense, that is important.
Good starting point, actually, Barry. I think where I'd actually like to start is with two things, actually. First of all, starting with the what question. So what is diversity inclusion? And then coming on to the why. So, you know, why is it important? So let's start with the what are we talking about here? It's interesting for me, actually, because I spend my life with executives all over the world. And most people talk about having a D&I strategy. And when they talk about D&I, they talk about it like that. So they say D&I, and they say it quite quickly as if the D bit and the I bit are, you know, kind of embedded together, which they are. But I think if we're going to be smart about this and have, I guess, strategies which are effective, actually what we need to do as a starting point is to separate the D from the I. And what I mean by that is something relatively straightforward, which is when I talk about diversity, in a way, I'm simply talking about the differences that we all have. And those differences could be the things that we would expect. So things that would include gender, ethnicity, sexual orientation, disability, often characteristics, if you like, under legal frameworks. But I'm also thinking much broader than that. So I'm obviously thinking about things like social background, maybe somebody's personality or their work style, perhaps if they're an introvert or an extrovert. So diversity is simply about difference in this broad sense. Organizational inclusivity is something which is clearly different from that. And inclusivity is about the extent to which organizations value people who are different from them, the extent to which organizations respect people who are different from them. But that's really not enough to create an environment which is truly inclusive, a sense of belonging. The question for me is to what extent do organizations leverage the different skill sets of people who are similar but also different? Now, what's interesting about this is that lots of organizations have and continue to operate under this kind of managing diversity philosophy. And Laura Listwood describes this in a really interesting sense, actually. She suggests, which I agree with, is that what most corporations are continuing to do is we really have this kind of Noah's Ark approach to diversity. You know, we have, you know, two of them, two of them, two of them, two of them, etc. What this approach has done, it's created a really interesting dynamic. The intention is quite good, but the outcome is something else, which is we have seen some increase in particularly gender and ethnic diversity in global corporations. But the dynamic generally has been this: high levels of organizational diversity, or I should say higher levels than organizational diversity, but still quite low levels on organizational inclusivity. Now, that's interesting, and we'll come on to this in a minute in terms of the data, because the data tells us that if you want to get any rewards from this, you have to align diversity with inclusion. But when we end up with a dynamic where we have people who are different in our organizations, but they're not necessarily valued, they're not necessarily respected, their skill sets are not leveraged, They don't have that strong psychological contract. They don't have that sense of belonging. They do one of two very basic things. One is they feel a sense of disconnect with the organization. And so they essentially start to vote with their feet. So we get this kind of talent drain, essentially. And it's almost like having this kind of, you know, maybe a metaphor is like having a sort of a, you know, a bucket with a hole in it. So we're pouring all this kind of diversity water in to fill up the bucket, but they're seeping out the other end because we don't have the right structures. What's interesting is not only do we see a talent drain therefore, but the data tells us something slightly more interesting, which is clearly some people do leave, but a whole bunch of people don't leave actually. In fact, they stay, but they do something else. And what they do is this: they mentally check out. Now that's even worse. This whole conversation for me is around saying, how can we make organizational decision-making smarter? And how can we create an environment where, you know, we have high levels of motivation, which leads to high levels of organizational performance? And the correlation of that would clearly be profitability if you're a profit-making business. You simply can't do that if you have this dynamic of high diversity, low inclusion. So the first message is the agenda is not about diversity. It's about the strategic alignment of diversity with inclusion. And once we align the two together, then we get the rewards.
So is that kind of aligned to, you know, thinking about diversity as a recruitment problem versus thinking about it as a, you know, cultural team and retention part of the equation? Is that part of what you're talking about there?
Yeah, you could simplify in that way. You could say that what we want is we want to recruit diversity into our organization. So diversity and recruitment are definitely aligned fundamentally. And then what you could say is, okay, once we're trying to get difference into our processes through our recruitment activities, the next question would then be, well, what do we do with them once we've got them in? And that leaps, I guess, from the diversity bit into that space of organizational inclusivity. So we've got all the difference in, but we're not really sure what to do with them.
So just segueing then on to the second part of that, why is this a very broad question, but why is this question, this topic even, why is it important?
I suppose there's a number of reasons why you could say it's important. The first thing that I would say is that I actually think it's the right thing to do. I do think that in the modern globalized age, which, you know, when we talk to professors at Harvard University, people like Professor Moskanta, she will tell us that the global age is defined by certain factors. So it's defined by, you know, uncertainty. You know, we see that at the moment. You know, we see lots of political, social uncertainty, complexity, social and technological disruption. But the other thing that she talks about is that the globalized age is defined by diversity. And so not only do I think it's the right thing to do, it is absolutely the smart thing to do, because external stakeholders, and they could be customers if you're private, or they could be, you know, community members if you're non-for-profit, are and will increasingly be diverse and different. And we know that just in terms of how demographics work and movement in terms of populations. But the other argument is around talent. So future talent coming out of university is diverse, and future talent is global. So that kind of exaggerates the principle of how diverse our talent is. And so there's a number of arguments in terms of, well, why does that matter? And the basic principles are this. We do know that when we have similarity, and not just similarity of gender, ethnicity, etc., but particularly similarity of thinking, that's quite risky actually in terms of organizational decision making. So similarity of thinking clearly falls into groupthink. So that's quite deficient in terms of our ability to connect with our external stakeholders who are different from us. So we want to reduce the risk of groupthink, but then we also want to have an uptake. And the uptake that we're really looking for is higher levels of connectivity with diverse stakeholders, higher levels of innovation and creativity. Now, there's a number of research studies which have now demonstrated that actually when we have, remember, not diversity, but when we have diversity plus inclusion, we do actually see a reduction of groupthink and an increase in innovation and creativity. So Deloitte, for example, they produced a report in 2018, and it's called The Diversity and Inclusion Revolution, Eight Powerful Truths. And what they've shown is that businesses that promote diversity and inclusive workforces, you know, they're twice as likely to meet financial targets, three times more likely to be high performing, six times more likely to be innovative and agile in their mindset and approach, etc. And that work is really built on some other research which has been conducted by, for example, Boston Consulting Group. Boston Consulting Group produced a really interesting piece of research in 2017, which really sought to measure the correlation between organizations which are diverse and organizations which are inclusive, and the outcome of that in terms of innovation. It's quite a significant piece of research, because what it's showing is that when we do align those two principles of diversity and inclusion, we can now chart a correlation between those and business innovation. That work, again, is built on previous research by people like Scott E. Page, who's actually interested in group decision making. And his work has shown that when we have essentially diversity of thinking around the table, we are much more likely to be creative. We're much more likely to solve extremely complex problems, etc. And this all falls into some data which McKinsey have been working on for a number of years, that clearly shows that when you have, and actually they've only been able to measure it on two metrics. So they've really looked at gender and ethnic diversity. But the McKinsey data has shown that when you have high levels of gender and ethnicity, particularly at that executive level, we see an uptake in terms of business profitability. So there are just a number of studies which have been produced in the last few years. And you know, when we add them together, I think it's now fairly unquestionable that diversity is the right thing to do, but it is absolutely the smart thing to do as well.
Yeah. One of the things I'm interested in is, I mean, I kind of feel like there's a given there, like we have the evidence and we have the, you know, that's the right thing to do. There's almost a moral imperative on top of the smart thing that you've just described. So what are the things, what are the hurdles to overcome?
Good question. The hurdles to overcome is essentially human beings. And what I mean by that is something which is simple, which is human beings have a neurological default position. We are neurologically designed to gravitate towards people who are like us. So we are designed to gravitate towards people who look like us, who sound like us, who think like us, who come from similar backgrounds, who share hobbies, who share interests, etc. And so that causes an interesting problem, actually. So even though organizations often have quite good intent to do those two things of bringing difference into their organization, our human brain gets in the way. And people like Daniel Kahneman have popularized the notion of cognitive biases, actually. And Kahneman, in his quite seminal work, actually, Thinking Fast and Slow, has really kind of conceptualized how the human brain works. And we've known this, you know, psychologists have known this for a number of years, actually. But he talks about the human brain as operating on two systems, actually. It's called system thinking. So we've got system one, which is our kind of fast thinking process. And that's the kind of automatic. So the brain is, you know, operates on automatic mode. It is not rational. It is emotionally driven. It's instinctual. It's very impulsive in terms of its thinking. And then you've got system two, which is more the kind of the rational part of the brain. But as the human brain is making decisions, so for example, in a recruitment context, when we see a resume, there is information on that resume which would be useful for a hiring manager to make an assessment of whether they want to select this individual for interview. But what the brain does is it sort of reads the resume, and it will, the conscious brain will essentially do what it should be doing. So it will look for experiences and competences, etc. But as the conscious brain is reading for competences and experience, the unconscious is also reading the resume at a super quick speed. And it's only really interested in one basic thing. And the thing that the unconscious brain is interested in is, to what extent is this candidate like me, or to what extent is this candidate like us in our, you know, the organizational collective? So this notion of likability is really playing out in terms of the hiring process. And there are clues or hints which the unconscious brain will look for. So they will look for things like, you know, what university did you go to? So if you went to Oxford or Cambridge or Durham, and the hiring manager went to Oxford, Cambridge or Durham, that automatically creates a sense of affinity. So we get that affinity bias playing out. There'll be other kind of clues, such as even, you know, your hobbies or your interests. One which I think is particularly fascinating is even based on somebody's name. There are research studies which are generally called comparative CV studies. And these studies have been done in the UK. A significant one was done by the Australian National University. Studies have been done in Sweden and all over the USA, Canada. And what all these studies show is that unquestionably, hiring managers, not at the conscious level, but at the unconscious level, are more likely to select for interview a candidate that simply has a name that fits within the dominant culture. So, for example, in the UK context, the UK government sent out almost 3,000 CVs for real jobs, real employers. And there were different names. So one was a white Western sounding name. One was a traditional African sounding name. And one was a traditional Asian sounding name. And the results were simply this. If you had a white Western sounding name, on average, you had to submit about 9 CVs, resumes, essentially to get that call up for interview. And if you had a traditional Asian or African sounding name, on average, you had to submit about 16 CVs. So that is a really significant differential simply based on name. So I'll use a word which is deliberate, actually, which is that decision making is actually irrational, because what we're looking for as hiring managers, or what hiring managers are looking for, is two basic things. One is competences. To what extent does the applicant have skills, experience, etc.? But the other thing that they should be looking for is potential. Now, there are all sorts of complexities around who gets into Russell Group universities, Harvard, Oxford, Cambridge, etc. But even if you disagree with some of the problems around it, there might be a rational argument to say, well, actually, if we have a graduate from Oxford or Cambridge, it's a safer bet, actually. So the risk is less. Now, I don't necessarily agree with that principle, but I can see the arguments around it. That's interesting. But when we're making assessments and selections for interview based on name, that is absolutely irrational. There is no way on earth that we could ever make a correlation between somebody's name. So I'll give you two data points. My name is Dan Robertson. Can you make an assessment of competences or potential based on those data points? One data point is Dan, second data point is Robertson. The answer to that is simply no, it's impossible. And yet what's interesting is we do that all the time. So we have this real problem, actually, in terms of how bias plays out. And there's lots of different types of biases. There's clearly affinity bias, which is that notion of likability. But other key types of bias, particularly in that recruitment context, confirmation bias clearly is a major obstacle in terms of hiring people who are different. So the first time that we'd see a candidate would be on that piece of paper. We would select either in or out based on arbitrary things such as name. The second time you would see a candidate would probably be at the interview. But once we have an original assessment of somebody based on information on the resume, we start to look for information which confirms either our positive or our negative of the candidate. So we know that confirmation bias plays out there. And then the final one is just the halo and the horns effect. And again, Kahneman talks about how the halo and the horns effect is really probably one of the most prevalent types of biases. And what they mean is, if there are certain competences that an employer values, so you might value, for example, you know, analytical skills, depending on what the role is. So if you have a candidate with high levels of analytics, you might start to assume that because they're great at analytics, they're really good at client engagement or presentational skills, but they're clearly different competences. The horns effect is the opposite of that. So if a candidate's not good at analytics, you might also assume that they're not going to be great with client engagement or something else. So they're the real types of biases that we need to be mindful of in terms of that kind of recruitment context.
This is absolutely fascinating, Dan. It's something that my agency have had challenges with, in the sense that we find it quite difficult to build a diverse team where we're located, which is in a relatively non-diverse area. What can organisations do to assist with bias removal when they're hiring?
Yeah, that's a good question, actually. I think there's a number of things that we can do. I think we can do things at the system level, so system redesign, and then at the behavioural level. So some simple examples. If we take the life cycle, if you like, so the first thing we do when we're hiring is we talk about job design. So, you know, person specifications, job descriptions. We know that without going too much into the whole psychobabble, language is separated between what's called agentic language, which is more male sensibilities. So terms like strategic player, you know, terms like even, you know, gravitas, those sorts of things. And then communal, which is much more female sensibility. But language and phraseology is embedded within person specs and job descriptions. So that's often a barrier for candidates there. So if we can remove that, and there's some smart technology these days. I mean, Textio is the classic one which organizations would employ, you know, the AI tool to just highlight those words and phrases. So we can neutralize bias to a certain extent from our job design process. The second thing that I would encourage organizations to do is really simple stuff, actually, which is in terms of candidate attraction, just think about the words, phrases, and images that organizations use in their campaign. So if you have an image, which is basically a whole bunch of, you know, white middle-aged men on your candidate attraction campaign, who's that going to appeal to? Well, clearly it's more likely to appeal to white middle-aged men. Is it politically correct to say that actually if we have women, minority ethnic images on there, that will make a difference? Well, actually, it's not about political correctness. It's about saying what is the science that says what works. And we do know there's actually a related concept called stereotype threat, that when candidates who are different see that image of a whole bunch of white men, they are absolutely likely to, or rather they're less likely to apply, and they are much more likely to be put off. So having diverse images does actually have an impact in terms of our candidate attraction process. And then if we follow the circle round, so if we talk about shortlisting, in an ideal world, it would be better if organizations used application forms as opposed to resumes, because what we would like to do is move much more towards blind decision making, which is taking information out of the process. So we try to mitigate, you know, the affinity bias. So if we can remove things like name, somebody's postcode even, if we can remove their hobbies and their interests. Some institutions now are even removing university from that shortlisting process. If we can do that, you know, all of that information goes on a front-end sheet. That would go into a HR database, and the hiring manager just gets another sheet that says, you know, one side, these are the competencies I'm looking for, and now the candidate has given their examples, which hopefully matches the competencies. That removes possibility for affinity to really kind of impact that shortlisting decision. I mean, there'll always be hints within the, you know, the candidate's responses, but, you know, blind decision making has actually shown to have quite a significant effect. And then I think finally, just in terms of interviewing and debriefing, I think at the interview stage, rather than do one-to-one interviews, I would absolutely recommend doing group interview processes and using a preset of questions. And what that does is it ensures that we stick to a script and that we don't go off track and start asking all sorts of questions, which really fall into questions around, what are you really about? You know, tell me about yourself. You know, all those, all they are is code for, you know, I'm trying to figure out to what extent you're like me or to what extent you fit into the organizational culture. So if we can avoid that and stick to a script and then use an aggregated scoring system. So if you aggregate scores from candidates and then use the aggregated score in the debrief, again, bias is more likely to be mitigated. And the final thing is just try and use some kind of like devil's advocate throughout the system. You know, somebody who perhaps even sits on the interview panel or is involved actually in shortlisting, is involved in the debriefing, and their role is to be your critical friend, your critical challenge. So if they hear conversations around organizational fit or around affinity bias. Their role is to call it out and essentially to keep us on track. Now, all of those examples I've given you, they're relatively straightforward, but the beauty is the evidence has said that they actually do absolutely without question have an impact, a positive impact in terms of getting diverse candidates through our recruitment process.
Brilliant. Thank you. And I guess that external person could be, so in our case, we have an external HR support. So it could be that person sitting in on the interviews with us.
Yeah, absolutely. It could be somebody from HR. It could be somebody from maybe even an affinity group. So many organizations will have, you know, LGBT networks or BME networks. My only reflection is that so it could be a wide range of stakeholders. I think it's important to have somebody who has an element of power in the organization. And the reason that's important is that when they do challenge, particularly if they're challenging people who are of the same grade or higher grade, you know, that their voice essentially carries some kind of weight. So we don't want people stuck in that process whose voice, you know, might be ignored from senior execs, for example.
I also just wanted to mention that there's a couple of books and links that you've mentioned there, which I'll add to the show notes. One is Thinking Fast and Thinking Slow, which is an outstanding book. And I think you also mentioned Textio and another tool.
Yeah, so Textio is the AI tool which has been shown to be fairly effective in terms of blind decision making. There are a whole range of tools. One is Gap Jumpers and a few others, but we can make sure that we send the links out actually so people kind of get a sight of what they are.
Yeah, cool. And as usual on happyporch.com, that's where those notes are. We've talked a lot there about those bias in the recruitment process, and you've described really well there are different types of bias. I wonder, is it the same thought process or the same kinds of things in terms of with building the team, really about retention, but in terms of team interactions and building and educating people in terms of working together?
The biases play out for sure. So we know that affinity bias, absolutely confirmation bias and the halo and horns effect, they will definitely have an impact. I think what's interesting actually is we know now not just what the biases are, but we also know what the impact of the biases are in terms of not just talent retention, but progression. So the hotspots are particularly things like work allocation. So managers who are responsible for teams and they're allocating work, if the work is fairly routine, bias will creep into the process, but it's not necessarily that significant. One of the things that I would ask people to watch out for is if they have perhaps a stretch project or a project which has high importance to them personally or high importance to the organization. We know that managers, because how bias plays out is at the underlying level, is bias is often governed by a sense of trust. So who do we trust? Well, we're more likely to trust people who are like us, people in our in-group actually. So we know that trust is a driver in terms of how bias plays out. So we're more likely to allocate stretch projects essentially to people who are like us. When I say that, that is correct. But remember, we need to interpret likability in a broad sense. So like us could play out across the lines of gender, ethnicity, etc. But it could also play out across the lines of personality and work style. But we do know for sure that work allocation is particularly a hotspot in organizations. The second thing is around feedback. If somebody's in your in-group, they look like you, sound like you, think like you. I think this is particularly interesting, actually, is if somebody gives the manager a piece of work back, which is substandard, essentially, not to the expectations of the manager might give them some fairly open and some fairly robust feedback, actually. If somebody's different, and it just depends on the degrees of differences, they're far less likely to give them that really harsh, direct feedback. The feedback would be around the edges, often muted, yet not as direct, etc. And the reason for that is really interesting, and partly it's due to two drivers. One is about the particular behavior. So if somebody's in your in-group and they essentially screw up on a project, what do? You say, look, you know, a bit disappointed, let's have a coffee, let's figure out how we can fix this. But the conversation can be fairly direct. And the reason you do that is because if somebody's in your in-group, managers can't always do this, but they think they know how that person's going to respond. So they don't get anxious around it. If people are significantly different, particularly based on things like race, that makes hiring managers much more anxious, actually. The second principle is around, if we go back to the notion of bias itself, when we think of the term bias, it feels quite negative. You know, nobody likes to think of themselves as being biased, even though we all are. But actually, one of the motivations for affinity bias is inclusion, which is slightly ironic. So motivation is not necessarily to exclude. Exclusion is an outcome of your driver to include. And what I basically mean by that is something very simple, which is, you know, if you look like me, you sound like me, you think like me, you know, you went to a similar university, you know, we just groove in the same way and you've screwed up. Well, actually, I've got some emotional connection with you. So I'm quite likely to say, you know what, don't worry about it. Let's go for a coffee. Let's figure out. So the emotional bonds and the prediction of behavior leads to one set of behaviors, which would be different from a set of behaviors where somebody's different and there's no emotionality connected to that. The third point I just want to raise is around most organizations these days will have formal processes such as mentoring and sponsorship of diverse groups. But at the informal level, that's something that we need to pay attention to. So who gets the informal sponsorship? So actually, one of my most precious commodities actually in life at the moment, something which is much more important to me than money, than anything else, apart from my family, is time. Time is my most important commodity. So an interesting question would be, who do I spend my time with? Now, in organizations, you know, if somebody's walking down the corridor and, you know, a colleague says to a manager, have you got 5 minutes? They might be like, yeah, sure, let's go for coffee. Somebody else might say, have you got 5 minutes? And they might be like, yeah, sure, check in with my secretary, she'll find some time for you. These are absolutely different responses to the same request. You know, this is what we call microbehaviors, our microbehaviors play out. So who do people spend their time with? You know, when they go to key client meetings, who do they intuitively take with them? When they're in a meeting, whose ideas do they support? Whose ideas do they close down? Who do they talk up even when they're not in the room? On their own, they're quite major. But now if we add the dots up, they are super significant. So if we're allocating work to people that look like us and sound like us, when we're giving them the feedback, you know, in a different way, when we're doing the informal support, you know, even drinks after work, building that affinity bias, etc., it actually does start to have quite a direct impact on people's actual skills and competences. So people that look and sound the same, they often do become competent, more competent over people who are different because of these processes. And it's interesting that when I go into global corporations, one of the first things that I often ask for is the pipeline data. And when I look at the pipeline data, it's fascinating that it often looks like people are already at the top. And these are the reasons why. So I think if we're going to think about how we can mitigate bias, it from that kind of inclusion, the kind of talent retention and progression perspective, we've got to deconstruct how it plays out. And then we can move into, right, now we know what's going on, what can we do about it?
Dan, one thing I'm interested there in what you just said is the informal support. Because a lot of the listeners and myself and Kelly are running or part of smaller organizations, I think the informal thing is maybe even more relevant or significant. Do you think that's a fair observation in smaller teams and smaller businesses?
I would absolutely say it is definitely at least as equally as important. I mean, I suppose, remember that even when you get large global corporations, actually, in reality, they're all a bunch of micro businesses internally. So if you think about a global law firm, you know, it could have, you know, hundreds of people in an office. Actually, they're governed by practice groups. And so the practice, you know, the partner in the practice group might have an associate pool of, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 maybe. And often even in big corporates, like whether it's, you know, banking or insurance, actually it's the middle manager that is responsible for the work allocation, the feedback, etc. And the middle manager generally might have, I don't know, a team of 15 or 20 or something like that. You know, we're not really managing 200-300 people. You know, they're sort of broken down by the organizational structure. So I'm not sure whether it would be more prevalent in small organizations, but it definitely would be equally as prevalent for sure. And as well as working with huge globals, we work with tiny charities, lots of non-for-profits. And without question, I have seen and experienced this kind of, or these kinds of biases. play out in those sorts of organizations. So I think the size of organization is less relevant, actually. Yeah. Mm.
Yeah, like Kelly just said, there's so much there and so much I would love to dig into more. One thing, Kelly, that I think was really interesting comment that you said to you emailed me recently was an observation around the interviews you do with female agency owners or founders, and that from your observations, in fact, a lot of them started while on maternity leave or with children or something along those lines.
Yes. So I did a little bit of Twitter stalking, Dan, I'm not going to lie. And I saw that you posted out an article, Six Myths About Women Leaders. And it was really interesting to me. So the myth number one was that women are not as ambitious as men. And it stated that it's often argued that women choose to throttle back their careers when their children are young. And I found that really interesting because a significant number of the women agency owners that I'd been interviewing had actually started their agencies when on maternity leave or with very, very young children. So I just found that really interesting that myth was even relevant. And I just wondered what your experience of that had been.
Yeah, and actually what you're suggesting there tells us something like super fascinating, which is, you know, these are obviously women who are, you know, super ambitious, you know, and actually imagine being on maternity leave and then starting a business. You know, that's really hard work. So the notion that women are less motivated, less ambitious, etc., just doesn't stack up to the evidence. And what I generally find is the blocker, I remember the blocker operates at two levels, actually. Actually, we can even describe it as three levels. One is what we might call the system itself. So, and what I mean by that is the processes and the policies. So I actually did a lecture fairly recently and argued that part-time working, it just simply doesn't work. It's not very practical. So maternity and paternity policies, the way that maternity and paternity policies are set up actually still acts as a disadvantage to women. So I think we should actually scrap flexible working, because what we're doing is tinkering and tailoring around the edges. So we say, you know, the default position is 9 to 5 or, you know, 9 till whatever we leave these days. But, you know, you can have, you know, half a Tuesday off here or, you know, maybe leave at 3:30. That doesn't stack up in terms of the pressure that men and women have, you know, in the modern age. So I think we should just get rid of it. And I think we should operate on a system of what we call agile working or dynamic working, where, you know, through technology, you can work in different places and just flex up your time and the rest of it. The other problem, though, is even if we did address that, it's the organizational culture. So I know women who are super bright, super clever, super ambitious. They have adopted some kind of flexible approach to work. But just the kind of the everyday comments, you know, the kind of, oh, you're leaving early today, are you? Or, you know, actually just being kind of overlooked for promotion, the kind of out of sight, out of mind mentality, which goes on in organizations and all of that. So, and the other thing which women fall into, which is a particular type of social bias which women face and men don't, was two actually. One is gender benevolence, and that is when women do come back after maternity. The intention actually of managers is positive, but the outcome is negative. So the intention is, look, person X has just come back from maternity. I won't give them this big stretch project because, you know, they need to figure out their work and life balance. But actually what they don't do is have an effective conversation with the individual. So rather than come to an agreement of what works with both, the manager makes a decision which is not giving you the stretch project. And when you don't get that, that clearly has an impact on your own development. The other issue, which is really important actually, is what's called the double bind. And the double bind is relatively straightforward actually. We measure colleagues and individuals on two metrics actually. One is warmth, how, you know, likability, to what extent do we like somebody. The other one is competence, is how competent do we see somebody. The ideal in an organizational context is we want to like people, but we want to see them as competent. The issue with organizations or with individuals is when women have children, they start to fall down the likability framework, because at the unconscious level, and quite frankly, at the conscious level as well, lots of managers say, oh, actually, now that's a bit of a headache for me because, you know, I've got to manage all this workload so other people have to pick it up. And then they don't get the stretching work when they come back. So they go quickly, some women, from high warmth, high competences to low warmth, and then they're not getting the work to low competences. But when women also behave in a particular way, so when men rather behave as assertive and confident, you know, quite, you know, those sorts of behaviors. And when women behave in the same way, they're not described as assertive or confident. They're described as bossy or pushy. So we see this really interesting difference in terms of attribution bias, actually, which we describe as the double bind, which women face and men simply don't face that same dynamic. And it falls under this kind of pattern, generally, of what we call think manager, think male, which falls into that.
That's really interesting, because it's something else that I wanted to ask you about in terms of gender bias in the classroom, because you talked a little bit there about how women are described as bossy rather than confident. And I wondered, you know, how far that goes back and what we can do to try and kind of eliminate gender bias in the classroom.
Yeah, I mean, it starts super young, actually. And I think if you think about when children grow up, first of all, where do we get our biases from? Well, we're not really, even though we have these neurological default positions of gravitating towards similarity, actually bias is a cultural phenomenon and it's historical. So bias is a learned process. So where do we get our learning from? Well, we get our learning from the family environment. So what is the role of your parents as you're growing up? What are the types of jobs that you see your mother do? Or what are the types of jobs that you see your grandmother or your aunties do? What are the kinds of jobs that you see your uncles do, or you know, maybe older brothers and sisters? So what we see in the family home starts to dictate a neurological connection in terms of the roles of men and women. And that connection is reinforced through every time we turn on the TV. This is a really interesting study, which is called Redrawing the Balance. And they did, and we can send a link to this actually in terms of the after the podcast. They asked children in primary school to do some drawing, and they asked them to draw a fighter pilot, a surgeon, and a firefighter. And this was a mixed class of boys and girls. And what they essentially found is that I think out of 61, I think the number is 57 boys and girls drew men as firefighters, pilots, and surgeons. And what's interesting about that is that the girls were just as likely to draw to equate those roles with maleness as the boys. So we know this process starts super young. And we also know there's lots of these micro behaviors again, which play out. So when we're in the school playground, or when we're, you know, taking kids out a weekend, what do we say to the boys? Go off, go and run, have a play, climb the tree, you know, don't get too dirty, but, you know, off you go and behave. With girls, actually, what do we say? Something absolutely different. Don't mess up your dress, you know, don't run too fast, you're going to fall over. You know, so all we send out these constant cultural signals, which says to boys, you behave in this way, and we say to girls, here's a different set of signals, and you behave in this way. And when a girl behaves in a way which is we define as too masculine, we label them. So we label them as tomboys or something like that. And that's a controlling mechanism, actually, to keep girls in their particular gender. And the same principle applies to boys as well. So when a boy acts too feminine, again, you know, there's names and things like that. And kids, as we know, can be just as cruel as adults. So, you know, the names that boys and girls may get in a playground are often designed at the unconscious level and sometimes at the conscious level just to keep us into our kind of gendered norms.
Yeah, so much there as well. Unfortunately, we're starting to run out of time, Dan, otherwise I would love to keep going. But one final question, or maybe some, or maybe a final point to leave our listeners on, or leave me on, thinking about bias, what are the next steps for me or for our listeners to look at to learning more about my bias, how I can change that in myself and in my team?
Yeah, so we'll end with a positive, shall we, which is it's not all doom and gloom. We do know, actually, that you can't eradicate bias. That's not neurologically possible, but you can absolutely learn to mitigate it. So some things to think about. First of all, get tested. And I mean that. And what I mean by that is there is a test which is called the Harvard IAT. If listeners Google something, so if you Google Project Implicit, that's Project Implicit, It was developed by Harvard University. It's a pretty cool test. It's the only test globally which can measure your unconscious biases on a whole range of different groups. The test is free of charge. It takes about 10 minutes. If you do a range of your tests, you'll get a score. I would see that as a piece of individual intelligence, because if it throws up a test, whether it's based on gender or disability or something, that's quite smart information, because then you can say, well, with groups A and B, actually, I've got a relatively low level of bias. So when I'm around those groups, I know that I'm not particularly vulnerable to my biases, so I can relax. If I have a higher level of bias towards, let's say, somebody with a physical disability, when you're in work or in the presence of somebody with a disability, you can simply pay more attention. So that brings to awareness what your bias is, and it helps us to adjust in terms of behavior. There's some other principles around what's called individuating, which means don't lump groups together. So when we have experiences, we have a general tendency to cluster. So for example, if you ever go on holiday, and I don't know, you go to, let's say, Rome, we might say, oh, we've been to Rome, and we use language like, all Italians are. So we'll cluster cultural groups. So rather than saying all women are or all Italians are, we should individuate by name. And that again starts to break down biases. The other things that we can do, so contact has shown to have some quite interesting effects actually. So the contact hypothesis is around just get to know people who are different from you. And how do you do that in the world of work? Have coffee, have lunch, have dinner with people who are different. When you're organizing social activities, make sure they're organizing in a way which everybody can participate in. The other things that I would say, though, which do have quite an important impact, is two basic principles. One is the principle of amplification. And what amplification simply means is learn to amplify the voices and the skills of people who are different. And how do you do that? Well, you do that through when you're constructing a team, maybe it's a project team, make sure that you have diversity in your project team. When you are organizing, maybe it's an internal event or you're going to an external event, who just think very basic things. So question who's on the conference panel. Make sure that if you basically construct a conference panel with more women, more BME groups, etc., that starts to send signals to people who are different that we value talent and you also can make it here. So providing speaking opportunities, you know, rotating those presentation slots with difference in mind, that's really important. Making sure that even internal communication, so, you know, internal, whether it's reports or annual reports, they have diverse images on and the rest of it. I would encourage people to think very carefully about work allocation in particular and feedback. Work allocation feedback is so critical in terms of people's career development. Sponsorship, there's been some interesting work from the Center for Talent and Innovation based over in New York. They've done some really interesting work around sponsorship. It's shown to be very effective. It's slightly more effective, I would suggest, than mentoring. So I wouldn't advocate not doing mentoring in an organization. I would stick with that, actually. But I would say if you really want to ramp this up, start to sponsor people who are different from you in your pipeline. Once we get to a conversation about who we should promote to a leader at those calibration meetings, it's way too late by then. So sponsor somebody early in the pipeline. So they're the basic principles I'd say, and these things are shown to work. Finally, what I would say is you can start to look for bias as well. And bias is actually relatively easy to detect because it results in organizational trends and patterns. So look for trends and patterns in your hiring process. So, you know, who's applying for roles, who's getting shortlisted, who's being appointed, but also look for trends and patterns in your internal stakeholder population. So who's moving up the pipeline, who's staying in the organization, who's generally likely to leave, that sort of thing. And the final thing that I would add to that is, when I talk about look for trends and patterns using data, I mean data based on hard data, such as metrics around the protected groups, but also use things like employee engagement surveys. They're often a useful way of measuring warmth or coldness in terms of organizational culture.
Outstanding. Thank you so much, Dan. Really appreciate your time today. There's so much there and it's really interesting. It's a really good kickstart to our season, our episodes, our upcoming episodes, talking about diversity and speaking to different people.
Thank you so much, Dan. That was incredible. Thank you.
Thank you all very much.
And Dan, just finally, just to close out, where can people find out more about you and about the work you do?
So they can find out by going to vecedaconsulting.com. That's vecedaconsulting.com. I'm happy, you know, we also have a whole bunch of free resources, so people can email me at dan@vecedaconsulting.com. I'm more than happy to send out, you know, we have a philosophy of sharing, more than happy to share information. So they either come to the website or just email me. Perhaps I can send you my details and we can put that in the kind of links at the end of the stuff as well. And we can go from there.
Absolutely. Yeah, we'll definitely do that. Link everything on happyporchradio.com. Thanks again, Dan. Thanks, Kelly.
Thank you. Thank you both.
Thanks all.
You can get all the links and notes from this episode on happyporchradio.com, where you can also find out how to send us questions, feedback, and get involved in the conversation about this series. If you enjoyed the show, please share with anyone else who might enjoy it too. Thanks for listening.